I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. On Sunday, the CDC recommended that everyone stay away from gatherings of 50 or more people in order to slow the spread of coronavirus. President Trump said yesterday, keep it to 10 or less. Last Friday, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf shut down all the public and charter schools and yesterday called for a statewide closure of non-essential businesses. Yesterday, New Jersey Governor Murphy closed all state schools starting tomorrow and established a curfew. Delaware Governor Carney has closed all schools in that state for 2 weeks and issued other restrictions. Public health experts are calling for social distancing, but pictures of jammed airports and bars, even at Disney World, show the public is not heeding the warning. Joining us is Carolyn Canusio. She's director of research at the Center for Public Health Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a social epidemiologist and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And Carolyn Canusio, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here with you.
We're very happy to have you. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Carolyn, some people are heeding the warning, but many people are not. Is there something wrong with the messaging about social distancing?
I think that we've been slow to get this message out, and the messages have been highly inconsistent. So you see this evolution. Just about a week ago, Philadelphia leaders recommend that our city residents avoid crowds of 5,000 or more. And now that moving target has ratcheted all the way down to a recommendation by the president yesterday that we avoid crowds of 10 or more. I've been saying for a couple weeks that we need to limit all non-essential face-to-face contact. We're really trying to deprive this virus of the chance to encounter a new susceptible host. And we need this dramatic action now. We're asking people to make this radical behavior change all of a sudden. So I think it's hard for people to cognitively catch up with that and then to change the behavior.
If we had, and I do want to talk in more detail about what social distancing is all about, but if we had enough test kits, would there be a need for so much distancing?
That's an interesting question, and different countries have taken varied approaches to controlling this pandemic. So several countries in Asia had developed excellent active surveillance systems with testing capacities that allowed them to get on top of this as soon as they had their first cases and to test people, identify people who were ill, and then isolate those people and trace all of their contacts so that those people could also be removed from the social sphere. And they've managed the epidemic that way. And South Korea has been known for doing a great deal of testing, too. These are countries that took public health infrastructure seriously and prepared after SARS and MERS for the next new pathogen. And our country was really caught. We were all caught on our heels here. So it's not that it's an either-or situation. Mm-hmm. Both things should happen actively. We need to dramatically ramp up testing. And we need to actively, immediately engage in extreme social distancing.
You know, so much of public health is about basic health, about things like hand washing. We're talking about keeping your distance from other people under this particular pandemic. So on the one hand, these are things that people can do. On the other hand, it feels, if you don't mind me saying, so unscientific.
There are definitely areas where common sense has to prevail because we don't have an experiment based on a similar COVID-19 epidemic. Right. So we're extrapolating from the information we have often about flu. And this disease may operate similarly and it may not. And you're right, though, that some very basic behaviors and also the conditions in which we live, which are driven by policies and people's socioeconomic status, those things influence our health dramatically every day. And this worldwide crisis is making it highly visible that people who are vulnerable, for example, because they lack secure housing or because they don't have enough money to have a full pantry, these people who are vulnerable every day are now coming to our attention more.
I mean, clearly this pandemic has shown the vulnerabilities, the weaknesses in so much of our various systems that we use, including our health system.
That's absolutely true. And just before the case reports started to come out of China, I was getting messages from my friends about anticipated cuts to the NIH budget, the National Institute of Health. And I think what we're seeing now is that we can't gut our health care and public health infrastructure and at the same time expect that when we need care, it will be there for us, or that when we encounter a new viral threat, we'll be able to respond with alacrity to that threat. So we really need to make big public investments in these systems so that we have the protections that every person, when it comes down to it, wants for themselves, for their families, and for their communities.
In the meantime, since we have you on the phone, let's go over some of the basics that people really should be doing. We know about this graph there, so we need to be able to contain the spread of this particular virus. We're talking about hand washing, but we should be very specific about the kind of hand washing that you suggest that all of us do. Can we start there?
Well, I would love to actually start with what I think is the most important driver of disease transmission. And I think the most important driver is face-to-face contact rather than touching a surface that has viral particles on it. Okay, so let's start with face-to-face contact.
Sure.
Because scientists really think that that is what's driving most of the transmission of this virus that causes COVID-19. So, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so 6 feet, right? No closer than 6 feet?
Yes, but also it means very much trying to limit the opportunity that you even need to navigate that 6 foot distance with a person outside your immediate household contacts or immediate family. So keep yourself out of public spaces as much as possible. And this is not like make a marginal change around the edges to your behavior. This is keep yourself parked at home unless you must leave home. We are at that point, and I know that people have been confused about whether this is actually an emergency. Right. They're partially confused because we can't see all the cases that are in the community because there has been such inadequate testing. I want every listener to know that my colleagues on the front lines in healthcare have been writing to me for the past 2 weeks saying, I saw a patient who fits the exact criteria for COVID-19. The patient desperately wanted to be tested. The patient could not be tested. I had to send them home without any information and without doing anything for them. So please know that the degree of community transmission is probably much greater than we are aware. And in the coming days, as testing capacity ramps up, those cases will come to light.
And we will hear about more cases. I mean, there's no doubt we're going to hear about more cases.
We're going to hear about more cases, and I want people to be mentally prepared for that because I think this is such a difficult, stressful time for every listener. And I think it's helpful to anticipate that when we hear about a huge surge in cases, it's not that all of those people were just infected.
Right.
That's been happening and accruing over a couple of weeks. So that will come to light in the coming days as testing ramps up.
You know, I'm thinking of people staying at home. I mean, for some people, that's a home with a well-stocked refrigerator and, you know, all the conveniences of modern life. And for other people, it is not that, and they don't have enough food, and perhaps it's a large apartment building where they're worried about, you know, taking the elevator down to the first floor. What do you suggest those people do?
Yes. So there are several actions I've seen local Philadelphia residents taking. For example, our neighborhood in Fitler Square has been circulating an excellent Google form where people can sign up both to provide aid and to receive aid. And it's very specific. People can offer to provide money for community residents in need, can offer to deliver groceries to people in need. So there are these informal networks. Then, in addition, the mayor has announced 50 meal pickup sites for children who are out of school and therefore missing school breakfast and lunch. So it's important to look at the city website for that. Organizations like PhilAbundance and MANA, I encourage people to give to those organizations right now, to give money to those organizations right now so that they can continue to do their good work of distributing food to people in need. In addition, those organizations often rely on retirees as their volunteers. And I know young people who are healthy and at lower risk of having adverse events if infected with the virus that causes COVID-19 are asking for ways they can help. And a good way to help would be to get in touch with organizations like MANA or PhilAbundance to see if they can consistently volunteer and work along the protocols that those organizations are developing in order to safely continue these really life-sustaining services.
We are all in this together. You know, we were lucky in Philadelphia over the weekend and even yesterday. We had some really nice weather. People were outside taking walks, riding bikes, walking their dogs. What do you think about taking time outside? Is that, if it's possible, is that a healthy thing to do?
I think as long as people are maintaining their distance from folks outside their immediate household contacts, it is a healthy thing to do. So I suggest to people that they find places that are more sparsely populated or that are isolated and go there for a walk, a run, a bike ride, or just to sit outside in the woods or by the river. But what I've seen that concerns me is that people are gathering with friends and having picnics. People are having play dates among children. And we've just taken these very dramatic steps of shutting schools and now shutting non-essential businesses. These are going to hurt people in so many ways. They're such disruptive steps. And yet we should make the most of those steps. And that means refraining from the beloved social contact with your community. Don't have the picnic now. Even if you're young and think you're not vulnerable, don't have that picnic now, because every case we prevent prevents countless other cases down the line, and you will be preventing deaths, and you will be helping to keep our healthcare system functioning. And that's one of the things that's really motivated me to raise my voice on this issue.
And you know what, Carolyn, I want to take a short break and then get back to our conversation. And that is Carolyn Canusio. She's Director of Research at the Center for Public Health Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about social distancing, physical distancing, and how to stay safe. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Carolyn Canusio. She's a social epidemiologist at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about why social physical distancing really matters as we all deal with this coronavirus. And also, we do want to talk about how to stay mentally healthy when we're so socially isolated from other people. And again, you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, this is for you folks. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Carolyn, I'm thinking about social isolation, and especially for older people who were told really to stay home and not go out. But oftentimes these are people that really need other people around them in order for them to stay safe and to feel connected. How do we find that balance?
It's such an important question, and I'm glad you asked it, because we know that in normal times, without a pandemic, social contacts actually promote health and are associated with better outcomes for a number of health conditions. So it is important to try to maintain connection, even though that connection won't be physical. Mm-hmm. And I think we discuss it with regard to elders, and that's critical. Like many of your listeners, my mom is right now living alone in her home on the east end of Long Island, and she has been very diligent about not going outside into any public space. She has walked around her very quiet neighborhood, which I think is important for her physical health and maintaining strength. But she hasn't gone into any public space. She hasn't seen any friends. So every day our family calls her and FaceTimes her, and she's actually helping me by taking an hour or two a day to assist with what we're calling virtual homeschool. And she's helping two of my four children to read, play games, do math. So she's needed. I need her right now.
I hear you.
And she needs us. Yeah. So I say, you know, play games, sing songs, tell jokes, try to keep some of the joy of our social contact going through telephone calls, through letters. I have other ideas, but I'll pause to see if you have more.
I always have more questions, but no, that's fair enough. And we've got listeners with questions as well. We could do a whole hour on this related to schools. And as we all know, a lot of schools in this country have been shut down or are being shut down in order to protect children. But there is a downside to that, or I guess a risk for that, in that children then don't get the kind of socialization that they get at school. Also, there's a question about once they go home, you know, who is there to take care of them, especially if, you know, mom and dad or grandmom or whoever's taking care of them needs to be able to work somehow. Do you have a position on school closure?
I think it was necessary. I think this is such a lethal viral illness, and our options for controlling it are limited because we don't have a vaccine and we don't have effective treatments. And we know that in places like Italy that are just a few days ahead of us, the healthcare system is overwhelmed. So this very stark emergency calls for stark measures. So I think now that we've taken that step, we have to figure out ways to ease the burdens created.
You mentioned Italy. I mean, if we don't take these measures, will we be Italy in the next week or two?
Yes. I think that every person who's on the fence about whether or not to engage in social distancing, and every household in which there's discord or disagreement about the importance of social distancing, should go online and read firsthand accounts from doctors in Italy. I know that in my house a couple weeks ago, my daughter was still playing basketball at a tournament, a neighborhood tournament. And I said to my husband, this can't happen. Read this. And he said, oh my gosh, you're right. And he turned on a dime and his behavior radically changed. And he has been home since, basically. So I highly recommend that people become aware of what's going on in Italy and use that to motivate our behavior so that we do every single thing we can to protect ourselves, our families, our communities, and especially the vulnerable populations at risk of adverse outcomes.
And I think part of the anxiety is there's so much we don't know about the virus. We are learning, but there's so much that frankly we do not know. And we don't know how long this is going to last. And I think that creates a kind of anxiety about, is this going to be my life for the next week or two, for the next month or two, all of that?
Absolutely. So I think we have to have compassion with ourselves and with all the people we care about, because it's hard for people to rapidly ramp this up and understand the gravity of the situation. What I've been suggesting to my students and to the people who are calling me all day long to ask me for advice is to try to identify the things that are within our control. Stay home as much as your work circumstances and family circumstances allow you to stay home. And then face those decisions that need to be made in the near term while deferring decisions that could be made later. As you've seen just over the past couple of weeks, official recommendations have evolved rapidly as we've known more about the crisis in the U.S. So decisions, for example, about travel that seemed fraught and difficult 2 weeks ago are now really being made for us. So try to just look at what's immediately ahead and imagine some distant future when we're going to get through this, and we will get through it with a lot of hardship for people and difficulty, but we will get through it. But for now, look at what's happening today and focus on what you're able to control today.
Here are a couple of questions from our listeners. John says, what do we know about asymptomatic carriers? Can they get others sick? Do we have an answer to that yet? Do we know?
I think evidence is accruing, and there seems to be a growing consensus in the scientific community that asymptomatic spread is possible. Mm-hmm. That, and I just want to explain what that means in very simple terms for listeners who may not be up with the jargon. That simply means that people who do not appear sick but have the virus can still transmit the virus to other people. And that makes for a very difficult public health challenge. So I want people to assume that there's asymptomatic spread, even if we don't have absolute scientific certainty about that, because we need to take the most conservative approach possible, and therefore don't have play dates, assuming that you can just restrict them to kids without fevers and then safely avoid transmission.
Because someone can transmit it and not have the symptoms of the virus.
That's what we think is true now.
Here's a question from Matt. Do we know the incubation period for the disease? Do we know that yet?
It seems like most people begin to show symptoms at about day five, but 14 days is the incubation period that's been discussed as the period, for example, through which a person should quarantine him or herself if they have reason to believe that they may have been exposed.
Here's a question from Mary. How should we protect ourselves from exposure if we live with nurses or medical professionals? Interesting question there.
Such a good question. And I was on a call for 2.5 hours last night with my students, many of whom are themselves health care providers, health professionals. So we talked about this question a lot. People are taking different approaches to this. For sure, I would say a health professional should sleep in a different room than other family members if possible. I would say that that person should take their meals separately. Not prepare the meals if possible for the rest of the family. If they can stay elsewhere while they're caring for patients who are sick with COVID-19, that is something that was done in China. That was an important way to control spread. And I think a big challenge for us is going to be that evidence from China shows that people who are infected have a high chance of infecting their household contacts. So in China, it was important to halt the spread, to take people who were sick and isolate them in central isolation facilities, even if they were not so sick that they required hospital care or acute care. Wow. So I think that we're going to see, as this evolves, the need to adapt other spaces like dorms or hotels to become central isolation facilities and get sick people out of homes.
I am sure you have heard this. I certainly have, that people saying, well, you know, thousands of people die of the seasonal flu. Why do we have to have such draconian measures to deal with this particular virus?
Well, even though I'm an epidemiologist and we deal in numbers and statistics, I have been floored by the statistics about the possible number of deaths in the United States if we don't take extreme measures. They far outstrip the number of deaths from flu. This is far more lethal than seasonal flu, and it's a serious disease, and we don't have strategies, vaccines or medicines for effectively treating people. And in addition, we need to slow the case counts so that when people need ventilator support, there are enough ventilators for the people who need them.
How will we know if whatever it is that we're doing is working?
It's such a good question because, as we discussed, there's this backlog in cases that haven't yet been identified because testing has been so limited. So I fully expect, and I want all of your listeners to fully expect, that over the coming weeks, we're going to see an escalation in the number of cases, and it's going to make people feel defeated because we will be changing our behavior, but the case counts will keep going up for a while. That's because of the incubation period and because people have been sick who we haven't known to be sick, okay? So even though today I want people to stay home who can stay home, you won't see an immediate impact of that extreme behavior change on a societal level.
But it's, I mean, at some point in the distant or maybe near future, is there a point in which we can say to ourselves, okay, we're getting this thing under control?
We look at this this figure called an epidemic curve, which tracks the case counts every day. And you can see them online for all the countries that have gone before us in this pandemic. And you see that they climb because each person who is infected on average infects two other people. So you see that multiplier effect going on. And then you see, for example, in China, as they instituted draconian measures, you start to bend that curve back down. So we all long for the day when we start to see numbers go down rather than up day to day.
Well, Carolyn Canuzio, we have to leave it there. My thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times, giving us some very important and timely information.
Be well.
Yes.
Take care.
You too. Thanks so much. Carolyn
Canuzio,
you're welcome. Director of Research at the Center for Public Health Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. Joining us now is Dr. Rachel Levine. She's Secretary of Health for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Governor Wolf called for the shutdown of all the schools in the state and non-essential businesses to try to slow the spread of the coronavirus, as have other governors. And Dr. Levine, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here.
Nice to have you with us. How many cases so far have documented COVID-19?
As at our last count, we have 76 cases in Pennsylvania with COVID-19.
And my understanding is that there were 13 more cases identified yesterday. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And do we know how many suspected cases there are, or is that just too speculative?
Well, we have persons under investigation, or PUIs, as we call them, and we have many cases that are being tested both at our state laboratory, but also tests now being performed by commercial laboratories such as Quest. And we don't know how many of those are being done because they're ordered by physicians and other healthcare personnel in hospitals.
Do we have enough testing kits in Pennsylvania?
Well, right now we have enough testing kits, but that is of concern. So for our state laboratory, we have testing materials and kits that we get from the FDA and CDC, and our supplies right now are adequate, but we are very dependent upon the federal government and their supplies. And so that's an ongoing concern, but as of today, we have enough. And we have heard that the commercial laboratories are really gearing up to be able to do many, many tests, and so that's very reassuring. In addition, our excellent hospitals and health systems are developing tests to be done in-house, and that also is a very positive development.
I've heard, though, and this is more anecdotal than anything else, from either physicians or even some hospitals, the concern is that there aren't enough tests, or the tests are not, we're not getting the results in a timely manner, feeling as if they cannot keep up with the potential threat.
So that had been a problem over the last number of weeks. It really is only 2 weeks ago yesterday that we were able to do any tests in Pennsylvania. Previous to that, all the tests were done at the CDC. 2 weeks ago, we started with 5 tests at our state laboratory, and then within 2 days, we're up to 25 tests, and now we can do 100 or more tests. But what we're really trying to do is to prioritize our state lab for testing individuals that have specific contacts with other individuals with COVID-19, or have a specific travel history, or if we're worried about a cluster. And we're really encouraging physicians and hospitals to use for people who are, have symptoms but have no other predisposing factor, to use the commercial laboratories. And so we're trying to stratify in that way.
Are we protecting the healthcare workers who are on the front lines, whether they're physicians or nurses or other medical personnel?
We are. So we, you know, healthcare professionals are when they're in contact with people who might have COVID-19, have what are called personal protective equipment, which includes the N95 masks that have been discussed. And right now, supplies are adequate. But as time goes on, there is a limited number of supplies that hospitals and health systems have. We have stores in Pennsylvania, but not infinite stores. And of course, there's a national storage and supply of back order of those, but not infinite. So it will be of concern as this COVID-19 epidemic and pandemic continues.
I know we have to say goodbye to you in just a minute or two, but yesterday Governor Cuomo of New York was complaining, frankly, that we don't have a national policy. We've got states and local governments coming up with their own policies to deal with this pandemic. Do you think it's smarter to have a kind of one size fits all to deal with what's happening in the country, or does it make more sense to make the response more regional or statewide?
I think that it's best to have both. I think we need a national strategy that states have the ability to operationalize and to implement, but make changes depending upon our state's needs. And then also we work with county and municipal health departments, for instance, such as the Philadelphia Health Department or the Allegheny County Health Department in Pittsburgh for local needs. So I think it requires all three levels, national, state, and local, to implement strategies to mitigate the spread of COVID-19.
And final question, we've got about 10 seconds or so. Can we avoid what's happening in Italy?
The goal is through our assertive mitigation efforts that Governor Wolf implemented, as well as other governors, that we will be able to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 so that the extreme measures in Italy are not necessary. And I'm a positive and optimistic person, and we're going to hope and pray that we're able to do that.
Well, I sure hope you're right. And thank you so much, Dr. Rachel Levine, Secretary of Health for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We have a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about the law, your responsibilities, and the threat of coronavirus. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're listening to Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about what you need to know about social distancing as the coronavirus pandemic continues to grow. Now what you need to know about your rights and your responsibilities as governments, including in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, close schools and businesses, establish curfews and travel restrictions. In New York, the governor quarantined a part of New Rochelle in an effort to contain the spread of the virus. Millions living in the Bay Area in California were ordered yesterday to shelter in place. These drastic measures are designed to contain the spread of the virus, for which there is no treatment and no vaccine. We asked Scott Burris to join us. He's a professor of law, also director of the Center for Public Health Law Research at Temple Law School. And Scott, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
And to our listeners, we're shifting gears, as I said, talking more about rights and responsibilities. You can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Scott, should we be prepared to give up some of our personal liberties for the greater good of the community, even the country, under these circumstances?
Well, we are being asked to do that, and it appears to be reasonably necessary in broad terms for us to do that if we want to prevent large-scale deaths from this epidemic. So I think the answer is yep. Look around you. It's happening.
We've been here before?
Not quite. No, not any time in living memory. And that's what I think makes this really an interesting and difficult set of questions for law. We've had quarantines before. We've had, you know, individual people, even, you know, schools or, you know, communities that are to some degree sort of shut down because of something like measles. We've had border controls and screening and so on for Ebola, and had people, you know, asked to isolate for 21 days. But we have not had a situation where we're shutting down the entire country.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, it's shocking, I think, the speed of which we're doing it, although we are clearly playing catch up when it comes to this particular virus. I thought it was interesting that Governor Wolf of Pennsylvania, who basically told non-essential businesses to shut down, is he's not going to send the state police or the National Guard to enforce these closures. And I'm not sure how that applies to other states or other governors across the country, but I thought it does raise some interesting legal questions.
Well, not really. Legal questions are pretty, it raises a bunch of sort of enforcement and social questions. Right. The law is pretty clear across the country that once a public health, you know, directive has been placed in the form of an order, like this, it's enforceable. It's usually a misdemeanor, but you can get a ticket, or you could get arrested, you could get fined. So the enforcement power is there. But what really happens in terms of putting this law into practice is that the customers don't show up.
Right.
I mean, once the message gets out that we really shouldn't do this, once the rationale is clear, once the social norms start to kick in, I think our problem is. To some degree, very different. You know, it feels like maybe it's hard to start all this, but actually the challenge is going to be how do you stop it?
Yeah, and then hopefully how to revive it at the end. Do voluntary closures and even people to self-quarantine, are voluntary measures more effective than ones that are strict by the law and even strictly enforced?
Well, in almost all rules, most people comply voluntarily. Like, for example, we decided to ban smoking, you know, around the country, you know, 15, 20 years ago. It's not as if there were police out issuing millions of tickets. The vast majority of people obey the law voluntarily. And certainly in a situation like this, when their life or the life of their loved ones could be on the line, I think you see a huge level of voluntary compliance. And then the second level is that people give people the evil eye. We're violating. So your neighbors are going to enforce this policy. And you'll have this residual group of people, potentially, who are going to be either knuckleheads or, and I think this is another thing we want to talk about, economically desperate, that may require something else. But even there, certainly with the economically desperate, I don't think it's a question of giving them a ticket. Right? It's trying to figure out when people are not complying, why aren't they complying? And what do we need to do to make it possible for them to comply?
Well, what I think this virus and this pandemic has shown that there is unequal pain. And I've said this several times already about revealing inequities in our system. And I think what you were referencing is that when people are told to stay home, but you could lose your job or you have childcare issues. I'm just thinking of the myriad of things that people have to deal with, especially if, let's say, you're low income and we're in a city with a high percentage of people who are poor.
Oh, I mean, this is where we should be looking from a legal point of view, I think. This is where the action is going to be. You know, as a professor of public health law, I'm inundated with people asking me, well, is it legal to, you know, stop travel or to quarantine people? And, you know, broadly speaking, the answer is, yeah, sure. But the really important legal question, I think, and I think these are completely new and completely challenging to our constitutional system, what rights do people have when they are severely impaired financially or socially by collective measures necessary to keep us safe?
Right.
Do people have a right to some kind of basic income? Do they have a right to their house and not to be evicted even if they can't pay their rent? We have a constitutional right to an education in most states in this country, if not all states in this country. And we're having people talk about, well, this may be the year we don't have school.
Yeah.
Well, it's not good enough. Right. I mean, it is important that we do all the things that have been outlined, I think. I mean, I so far feel like we're doing what we have to do. We don't have much of an alternative. That doesn't mean we can do it. It doesn't mean it's feasible over the long term. And it doesn't mean that we can stop there and say, well, let the chips fall where they may. Each step we take that shuts down people's livelihoods, their businesses, their opportunity to work, we have got to figure out what the next step we take is to deal with that.
Well, I know that Congress is wrestling with some of these issues about what to provide for people in these very difficult times of stress and possible unemployment. I heard, he's Senator Mitt Romney saying everyone should get a $1,000 check in the mail. Is that something that you think, Scott, is at least a sign that we're trying to deal with some of this stuff?
Well, I think definitely we are. I mean, the talk is an important sign that we're trying to do this, and it's going to be hard to figure out. Like, let's start right off the bat. I teach at Temple University, and thanks to the Internet, we can pretty much proceed as usual. I'm going to continue to do my work. I'm going to continue to do my research and my teaching. All my staff is continuing to work, and we're continuing to get our paycheck. So for us, it's kind of like, well, I'm working in a different place.
Yep.
But what about the people who have the food trucks outside school, you know, who basically don't have a business if we're not showing up on North Broad Street? Those are the people who need the $1,000 and maybe more than $1,000. I don't need a thing. And figuring out how you do that is already, you know, a set of difficult issues. How do we get the money where it needs to be? How do we get it there as fast as possible? How do we figure out, you know, how we're going to sustain that?
Do we have a nimble enough system?
Exactly. This is a time, and I think that's a great way to put it. We can be nimble. An interesting thing about what we're seeing with the emergency measures is that essentially emergency health law was designed to allow nimbleness. Mm. You know, 220 years ago, we had a yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia, and the government kind of evaporated. And the only people who stayed were the mayor and a bunch of sort of business people like Stephen Girard. And they essentially formed an illegal junta, or they were sort of appointed by the mayor as a kind of posse to run the city for 3 months. And they just did what they needed to do. And after that, the idea of a sort of board of health came into being in American law when people said, you know, when there's an emergency, we basically just need to find the people who are willing to stay and know what to do and let them do whatever they think they should do. So we are actually seeing nimbleness now in these restrictions. But we're challenged now in the modern world to have nimbleness for how we keep people's income going, how we keep businesses open, how we manage the rental real estate market, how we manage, you know, social services. This is something where real creativity and a willingness to just break the mold is crucial.
Scott, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Scott Burris. He's a professor of law, also director of the Center for Public Health Law Research at Temple Law School here in Philadelphia. An email from Richard. He says a friend came down with seasonal flu. Should they be required to contact their primary care physician? Are we at this point yet?
Well, I think the problem we're having now, again, is do we have the capacity to manage the surge? So making a rule that says you have to call is sort of what you do, maybe, after you figure out whether primary care physicians are ready and know what to do to manage cases as they come in. You know, my primary care provider, I think, is doing the good thing. They've sort of emailed us all and said, call us first. Don't come into this. You know, let's do triage. Let's figure this out. And you know, of course, as you've already heard on the show today, the single most important epidemiological thing now is that we get a test.
Absolutely.
We are operating in the dark.
I heard Dr. Fauci yesterday, he's the country's leading epidemiologist, saying with virus, and I think particularly this particular virus, we're just always playing catch up. I mean, the virus is kind of ahead of the game, and we're trying to figure out how to mitigate its effects.
Right, and that's actually something that we shouldn't be shocked by or terribly worried about, because it's inevitable. And the question is not whether you're behind, it's how far are you behind and how fast do you catch up. And for a while, we were not even trying to catch up, but now I think we are in overdrive to catch up. And as I say, I think if we can get a test going, I think that's going to be a game changer in terms of allowing somewhat more nuance and predictability in how we're going to lay out these restrictions across the country.
I mean, we are learning that the CDC, you know, their public health programs that have been either unfunded or underfunded. There was an NSA program dealing with public health that was shut down, apparently, by Bolton a couple of years ago. I was reading about a 450-page guidebook, I think, came from one of the public health organizations about how to deal with a pandemic, and no one is following that advice. At least that was as of a couple of days ago. Should we be worried about our public health system?
Oh, we should be terribly worried. It has been chipped away at from a budgetary point of view for the last 25 years at least. And it's easy to chip away at it when you don't have a pandemic,
right.
When you don't need it, and it has been able to rise to smaller events like anthrax and swine flu and Ebola pretty well. And it's sort of able to limp along managing, chronic disease and tuberculosis and smoking. But, if you do not have, put it this way, the model that I always thought worked nicely at CDC when I used to work with a lot of people at CDC in the AIDS era, is that there were a lot of smart people who had a little bit of time on their hands. They were not working, 50 hours a week just to keep up. They could sit and dig into data and think about what might happen next and start to develop plans and, increase their knowledge. And then when the surge hit, they had all these resources. There were people around, there was time around, there was ideas around. Now, everybody I know at CDC for the last, 10 or 15 years, they're working 50 hours a week routinely, and when things get bad, then it really ramps up. And that is not a recipe for preparedness.
The president declared a national emergency a couple of days ago, and my understanding is that frees up billions of dollars. But it does feel as if it's the governors, it's the mayors who are making these decisions about closures and curfews and things like that. Does that make more sense? And let me throw in something I put to one of our previous guests. This was coming from Governor Cuomo of New York, saying we need a national approach to this, not this patchwork of state laws.
Well, I think Dr. Levine's answer to that question was the right answer. We need, from a practical point of view, we need a national strategy and we need state and local tactics that can implement that broad strategy. It's also completely consistent with our law. I mean, the way our constitutional system is set up, the federal government was delegated certain powers. And in health terms, that meant basically interstate commerce and borders. But the primary police power to take action against public health was left with the states, and states divided with their cities. So this is completely normal and expected. And when you look at I was reading this morning the study that just came out of Imperial College that I think has influenced the Trump administration plan.
This is in England, right?
This is the English one where they've tried to model the both suppression and mitigation strategies. And what they talk about with our current strategy is, well, this is a minimum of 5 months if we're going to make it work. But after that, as we start to let up, there's going to be surges again, and there'll have to be returns to some kind of, lockdown periodically for maybe 18 months. But that can start to be done on a more local basis. So if we have a test, if we have good epi going on, and we have, strong state and local health departments, we don't have to shut down the whole country for the next 2 years. We can have rolling response that's more localized to need. So basically, I think that our state and local health department structure is an advantage, provided we have strong leadership and funding and expert guidance at the federal level.
Scott, just very quickly, if you don't mind, are there lessons from the AIDS epidemic?
Well, I think some of the lessons are capacity. Do we have to have enough people working who know what they're doing? So you need a strong public health response, and we've already talked about that.
Right.
Second lesson, I think, is the importance of civil society, of protest, of, groups like ACT UP. To a considerable extent, as we worry about CDC getting it right and being politicized, having people outside demanding that the federal government act and specifying how it should act and making sure it's not suppressing information is actually really important to the response. And it was very important to getting HIV right.
to stay 6 feet apart. Scott Burrows, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
He's a professor of law, director of the Center for Public Health Law Research at Temple Law School. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.